Hello and welcome to the Law Report. I'm Rachel Carbonell. Today, a special report from the front line in the Philippines. Heather Jarvis, Deakin University lecturer and former ABC journalist, has just returned from there. She's seen the extraordinary human toll of President Duterte's brutal war on drugs, including a killing that happened while she was there.
This is a war. Make no mistake about it. When we leave for our office, when we go to our home, you have to be ready to draw your gun and fight it out. This is war.
Begging for his life, he was saying, "Sir, I'm surrendering. I'm going to turn myself in."
He was shot, even as he begged for his life. Not since the time of martial law has so much blood been so deliberately spilt in the Philippines. During the Marcos years in the 70s and 80s, it's said that over 3,000 people, activists and critics of the regime, were the victims of extrajudicial killings by military or paramilitary forces. Now, a wave of unparalleled violence is gripping this nation of over 100 million people. In just over 4 months, more than 4,000 have been killed in a war on drugs declared by President Rodrigo Duterte. The former mayor of Davao was inaugurated as president on the 30th of June this year.
We will not stop until the last drug lord, the last financier, and the last pusher have surrendered or put behind bars or below the ground if they so wish.
First, let's head down a narrow pathway to a couple of chairs outside a small wooden shack in the Rizal slum, not far from Manila's airport.
The older is Manolito G. Concordia. The second is Carlo Magno G. Concordia. The third is Nino Rita.
61-year-old Noli D. Concordia, a former bank employee, is proudly reciting the names of his six children.
Tony G. Concordia. And six Hansel G. Concordia.
At least, he used to have six children. His eldest, Manolita, was killed a few months back by unknown gunmen.
Banda pong alas 11 ng gabi, July 16.
It was July 16, 11 in the evening. My family and I, we were already inside the house sleeping when suddenly we heard successive gunshots. We heard that there were men in tricycles. We found my son in his home bathed in his own blood, and another person with him also shot.
Mr. Concordia says he has no idea why his son, Manolita, was targeted. He worked as a security guard, had friends in the police force, and didn't use drugs, at least as far as he knows. Manolita wasn't on a watch list. That's a list of suspected drug users and pushers compiled by police and local authorities. But he had been accused of being involved in drugs and was threatened in the weeks leading up to his death.
He has already noticed that there would be a man or men riding in a motorcycle, wearing masks, surrounding this place or going through this place, somehow threatening his son's life even before. And he would even say that sooner or later somebody in this area was going to perish.
Mr. Concordia says there are now fewer people out gambling or hanging around the streets at night. Police have become more present. There are more patrols, and that's made it harder for people to buy and sell drugs. He'd been hoping for that when he voted for Duterte in the presidential election. So in one sense, the strategy might appear to be working, but it's come at a heavy cost. Mr. Concordia misses his son dearly, and he and his family don't feel safe.
We still see those men wearing masks. We still see them going around these parts, going through our streets, and we still can't sleep peacefully at night with that fear.
The Philippine government's drug strategy is called Operation Double Barrel. Implemented by the PNP, the Philippines National Police, it's an all-out plan to eradicate the sale and use of illegal drugs, as well as drug-related crimes. The police use a picture of a double-barrel gun to illustrate the concept. They say the upper barrel targets the so-called high-value drug lords. The lower barrel, called tokhung, or knock and plead, targets the small-time users and pushers and offers them a chance for rehabilitation.
The campaign on drugs falls on two strategies, which is the supply reduction and the demand reduction.
That's Superintendent Joselito T. Esquivel, Deputy Director for Administration of the Quezon City Police District and a veteran of 32 years' service.
The supply reduction is when you go against the pushers. So you try to cut the amount of drugs in the market. And the other strategy is directed on the users themselves, the one who's buying the drugs. It's called demand reduction, so more on information campaign. What we're using now is Project Dobro Valor. On the first phase, the obligation of the police is to conduct intelligence build-up to know who these people are through the help of the local government. So if the people are identified, the policemen, the barangay, and other NGO will go to the house of the suspected user or pusher and will knock on their houses and will ask them to voluntarily surrender to avail of the government's intervention program for them to reform. But if they do not surrender, they are identified already by the citizenry, then the police will make arrest. For those who will surrender, that's the participation of the policeman. Now comes in the intervention or the human side of the strategy. So they will be assessed if they'll be needing counseling or there'll be immediate need for rehabilitation.
On the very first day of Operation Tokhung, more than 1,000 people surrendered to the Quezon City Police. Many more have surrendered since. In a city with only 300 beds for drug rehab patients, you can imagine the strain that's putting on the system. And it's not just about beds. There's a lack of trained staff, and community-based services can't cope with the burgeoning demand.
So what we have here, way past those gates are those for our pediatrics and adolescent cases. You will also see before you
Dr.
reach
Bien
that...
Dr. Bien Liabres heads the Bakutan Treatment and Rehabilitation Centre in Manila. Run by the Department of Health, the centre has an approved capacity of 550. But right now they have as many as 1,500 patients.
80 to 90% of our cases here are using methamphetamine hydrochloride. We call it shabu. Most of these cases are brought in by their families, but lately a lot have been coming in voluntarily because of the anti-drug campaign. Some of them have the fear that they might be incarcerated, and some of them even worry that they could get killed in the drug campaign.
As Dr. Liabres shows us around the complex, I'm introduced to Jake. That's not his real name, but it's the one he chooses to use. Jake's a former drug user and pusher. He's 35 years old and married with 5 children. He says he started using shabu at the age of 14 and later started selling.
Nagsimula po akong gumamit ng drugs sa mga barkada ko po.
At first I didn't want to use drugs. I wasn't interested in using drugs, but because of my group of friends, I tried to taste it and try it out, just so I could tell them that I finally tried it out. But that was it. After trying it out, I was basically hooked up until the point that they caught me. And even after going through a lot of jails or coming in and out of jail.
And how did you move from using personally into selling, and why?
When I was a teenager, I was only using, but eventually when I had a family of my own, I was back then, still had a job as a security guard, but I was also fired from that job because of my drug use. At that point, I had no other means for supporting my family and no other source of income. And that's when I got acquainted with people in that field or in that business.
When the killings started happening and other drug users and pushers were being caught or killed, Jake decided to surrender to local barangay officials. He thought that would be the end of it, but the officials passed his name on to police. Jake ended up at the top of the police watch list, and soon they came knocking on his door.
It
was actually two of us that were caught. When they came to my house, they were looking for me, and at first I didn't want to admit that it was indeed me that they were looking for, until they started hurting me and put a plastic over my head. And my wife panicked and started to hold on to me, and that's when I had to admit that it was indeed me that they were looking for, and I helped them find my other friend.
Jake says the scene unfolded in front of his children, and they're still afraid because of what they saw. What made it worse was that the police were wearing masks. He could only see their eyes. So until he reached the police station, he was blindfolded on the way. Neither he nor his family knew if they were police or vigilantes come to kill him.
I was terrified. I was really terrified, especially when one of them called somebody on the phone and told him, "We've captured him." I heard the response from the phone saying, "Itumban yun na," which means kill, basically, which means get rid of him or take care of it. That was the moment when I thought that this was my last day, my last night to see my family.
Why do you think they didn't kill you?
My wife was holding on to me so tight, and I told them that she was actually pregnant, 5 months pregnant. And I basically had to beg for my life.
Jake was lucky. The police let him live. When he's released from rehab, he plans to move with his family out of the city and stay away from drugs.
I have huge gratitude that I was given a second chance to live. And I can't thank my wife enough for all of her support and love. I also feel a lot of gratitude that the police somehow accepted my plea for my life and that they sent me here instead.
But while Jake has the chance to turn his life around, others caught in the war on drugs aren't so fortunate. In fact, when I spoke to Jake, he said he was especially concerned for the innocent people who have lost their lives, people with no involvement in drugs. One such person was a 5-year-old girl called Danica.
Danica is a very sweet girl, a very sweet child, very reliable. She doesn't want a dull moment. Every time she sees me unhappy or one of the members of the family looks sad, she just sings, she makes us laugh. She's a very jolly person, a very jolly child. She do a lot of stuff to make us happy.
Gemma Garcia sits at the table of her small shack made of wood and corrugated iron. We're in Mayombo, Dagupan City, about 3.5 hours' drive north of Manila, in a place that's prone to frequent flooding. In August, Gemma's granddaughter Danica was killed by masked vigilantes. They'd come to shoot Gemma's husband, Maximo. A stray bullet hit the young girl while she was bathing behind a tarpaulin. She later died in hospital. Gemma says although her husband was sick and had stopped using drugs some years ago, his name had been placed on a watch list. Not only that, but he was listed as a pusher. He went to the police station to voluntarily surrender and clear his name. But just days later, he was badly wounded and 5-year-old Danica was dead. Gemma still can't understand why.
My husband is a very kind person. He used to be very responsible, trying to earn for us. However, because of the illness, he stopped. But even though he's been ill, he's trying his best to do the household chores for me. He knows that I'm already tired from work doing some part-time job. Very sweet person, kind, and he doesn't have vices. That's why I wonder why he's been accused to be in drugs or something.
Since Danica's death, it's been suggested to Gemma that Maximo had ties with so-called drug lords, that maybe he reneged on a payment and so they came to kill him. But Gemma says that's not true. She also says his name's now been removed from the watch list. It was all a terrible mistake. Whatever the case, her husband, who'd supported President Duterte and his war on drugs, remains in hiding. And her family no longer trusts the police.
Para sa akin, parang natakot kami sa kanila.
We're not trusting the police anymore. In fact, we fear them, our lives, because they intend to protect my husband, but they failed.
Both Danica and Manolita are the victims of so-called vigilantes, armed killers who've been supported and even encouraged by President Duterte. After all, it was he who said this in relation to killing drug pushers.
Feel free to call us, the police, or do it yourself if you have the gun. You have my support.
But who are these vigilantes? Are they concerned citizens egged on by the president's rhetoric, or perhaps with a grudge to settle? Are they drug lords taking the opportunity to attack rival gangs or silence people who know too much? Or maybe they're crooked police and government officials, so-called drug protectors, covering their own backs, doing the hits themselves or hiring death squads to do it for them. The word going around suggests it's all of the above. You're listening to The Law Report on RN, Radio Australia, ABC News Radio and on the ABC Radio app. I'm Heather Jarvis. Rappler is a popular news site in the Philippines. It releases regular updates on the number of people killed in the drug war. It says more than 4,500 extrajudicial killings have taken place up to the end of October. 1,700 of those were people killed in police operations. On my final night in the Philippines, I see the disturbing results of one of those operations. It's around midnight, and I'm at the Ruxabago Tondo police station in Metro Manila. Just nearby, the police have been running a buy-bust operation, where plainclothes police try to buy drugs from suspected drug pushers. With me are my colleagues Margaret Simons and Dave Tacon, and a tired but determined mix of local and foreign journalists.
Okay. Just let it start.
We've come here after a tip-off. While we're waiting, our driver hears gunshots. Margaret and I jump in the car, and perhaps stupidly in hindsight, we drive towards the source. We hear three or four more gunshots before we're stopped and turned away by a couple of plainclothes cops. Next thing, we see the crowd of journalists running up the road, jumping over obstacles, following the police. We join them, and soon we see the distressing scene. A man's been killed during the buy-bust operation, as the uniformed officer explains.
There is a buy-bust a while ago, and we were able to capture this person. And when we caught this person in a buy-bust, the relatives went to assist to help him, and all my operative they resisted the presence of the police operatives. And on the way to the police station, the suspect grabbed the firearm of one of my operatives.
The man's body, his face a ghostly shade of white, lies on the road in a pool of blood. The blood dilutes and spreads in the steady rain. Journalists push in close to take photos of the scene. Then a tricycle, a Philippines auto rickshaw, arrives. Out jump the plainclothes police who'd turned us away just minutes ago. Margaret Simons asked the uniformed officer some questions.
Why is he being taken away by the scooter?
No, they will bring it to the hospital.
Is he still alive?
We will try to save the life.
We find out later that the man was confirmed dead on arrival at the hospital. But meanwhile, at the scene, while the police are giving a press conference, witnesses are contradicting their version of events. And we have questions too. Why did the police say there was only one gunshot when we clearly heard at least five? And why was it so easy for the suspect to grab the policeman's gun? Well, the police say the man was handcuffed with his hands in front, not behind. As they drove him to the station, he was sitting behind the officer on his motorbike.
My operative were very confident that the suspect will not offer any resistance while on the way to the police station, because the motorcycle where the suspect boarded is being escorted by two more motorcycles. So we were not expecting any resistance coming from the arrested suspect.
If the suspect's hands had been handcuffed behind him, not in front of him, would that have perhaps prevented this?
As long as you are handcuffed. It doesn't matter if you are handcuffed at the back or in front. As long
tonight.
As, yes.
It mattered tonight.
Yes, most likely if he was handcuffed at the back, most likely he was not able to grab the firearm.
A human rights activist I speak to says this is a popular tactic employed by police. They turn their back and leave their gun in reach, tempting the suspect to take it. That opens the door for their partner to kill the person, supposedly in self-defence. But in this case, it seems, there's even more to the story. This is what eyewitnesses have to say.
He saw them. He's basically saying that he wasn't handcuffed before he was shot. He was just running and...
Naglalakad lang? Tumatakbo, naglalakad?
Painante. Wala naman dalang shabu.
He was walking. He wasn't carrying any shabu, according to this kid, and that's when he got shot. Somebody from prison shot him. Begging for his life, he was saying, "Sir, okay, I'm surrendering. I'm going to turn myself in." And then he was shot. Even from his friends, their friends were hearing that he was begging for his life.
President Duterte most likely won't fulfill his campaign promise to rid the Philippines of crime and illegal drugs in 3 to 6 months. But police say that crime rates have fallen by 48% since the war on drugs began. And despite condemnation from the UN and the international community, the president appears to be enjoying a strong level of local support. This man is a self-employed business owner and driver. He says he voted for Duterte because he has heart.
93.9.
The Filipino people, we never knew how big the problem is already until the president stepped in and do what he's doing right now.
What about people's right to have access to a fair trial, to actually go through the judicial system?
It's their call. They can do it.
They can't do it if they've been killed, though.
They have their relatives. If they knew the policeman did that, why don't they just file a case in court? You know why no one's filing a case in court? Because they are satisfied with what they are doing. Because we are a much more peaceful country now.
But is the Philippines really a more peaceful country now?
Good God, what are you talking about?
That's Loretta Ann, better known as Etta Rosales. She's a torture survivor, a former member of the House of Representatives, and was chair of the Philippines Commission on Human Rights for 5 years up to 2015. She's not a big fan of the president or his policies.
He's always had this prejudice against human rights. And he claims, and the policemen also claim, that crime has declined by 49% way back in... When was that? About a month ago. And they're so happy. They're applauding themselves. I said, they're all dead. You know, your criminal, your petty, these guys who pickpocket, the young kids, they're practically probably all dead and so on. Because that's the way you have treated them. And it's not as if crime has declined, because crime has actually increased. Because these summary killings are crimes.
As the death toll grows, the families of victims are left with little hope for justice. Most are afraid to speak out. They worry about reprisals by the killers or their associates. And even if they want to take action, the court system is so overburdened that their case may not be heard for years. Attorney Ray Paolo, or R.P. Santiago, is Executive Director of the Human Rights Centre of the Ateneo de Manila University.
The Supreme Court right now has around 128,000 pending drug cases for around 715 regional trial courts all over the Philippines. And quite recently, the Supreme Court even increased the number of courts that are handling drug cases to practically all regional trial courts. That amounts to around a little more than 900 all over the Philippines. And that is how congested the court dockets are, only for drugs.
More than 60 organizations have formed a new coalition called I Defend, in defense of human rights and dignity movement. Elisa Carlos is its spokesperson. He says the war on drugs targets the most vulnerable.
It's clear that the scaffolds of the drug trade system in the Philippines is made up of involved corrupt police officers who recycle the drugs down to the streets, as well as the narco prosecutors, narco judges, narco politicians, and even officers of the correctional system, both jail and prison officers. It's clear that those being killed are from the lower rungs of the drug trade who do not have police protection. So either drug dependents or petty drug peddlers who sell to sustain their dependency or even to earn a small living. No?
He cannot be so simplistic as to say that all you have to do is to kill people and then you can get rid of drugs. I mean, if that is the case, then why don't we just kill all the, you know, all the criminals, the petty criminals, and just get rid of everybody? And so you solve the problem of criminality. It's as simplistic as that. So you have a problem there. You have a problem if this president thinks this way.
Eta Rosales. At his home in Rizal slum, Mr. Concordia, who voted for President Duterte, still hopes his son's killers will be found.
Of course, I still want justice for my son. He was not involved with anything illegal. He was innocent, basically, and it's really just because he was wrongfully accused of things he wasn't guilty of, and he's still hoping that justice will come for his son and his family, and peace too.
Mr. Nolly D. Concordia ending that report from Heather Jarvis. And a special thanks to the translators and to Margaret Simons, who did some of the interviews. That's it for the Law Report this week. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to technical producer Angie Grant. It's been great fun filling in for Damien Carrick while he's been off doing some fascinating investigative work at Background Briefing. If you haven't heard his programs there, then do go and check them out. Damien's back in the chair next week, and it's farewell from me for now. I'm Rachel Carbonell.